Our task before us tonight is to give attention to not a long book of the Bible, but an interesting and important one nonetheless. And so we will be doing our best to give a kind of survey and overview of this book of Lamentations. There's a few related discussions about this book that I'll bring to our attention here in a moment, because even the fact that we have a book like this in the Bible, I think, is very interesting. And I'll explain why that is the case here momentarily. But let me remind us, because in our English Bibles, you have the Book of Lamentations located where? And specifically, I would ask, right after what other book? Okay, it's right after Jeremiah, and that, for the most part, is strategic, I think, because generally we understand who to be the author of Lamentations. Jeremiah, and I would agree with that. He's not named there as the author of the book, and yet because of the timing of it, and it's kind of, you know, seems to be located there for that reason, we understand him to be the author of the book. In the Hebrew order, which is for the most part what we've been following here, we find this book in the nearer to the end of the Old Testament in this section called the Writings. So the Law, the Prophets, the Writings, and then we've examined how within that section of the Writings, there are these books that sometimes get this title known as the Small Scroll. And in the order of books here, we've mentioned this before, so I won't linger on this too much, but the order even of these books, I think, is intentional in the sense that they form kind of this recursive structure where Ruth and Esther are set across from one another, because in both of those stories, you have women as the title character, but you also have Gentiles who are brought in to help preserve the line and the promises given to the Jews. And then you have the Song of Songs, which we examined a couple of weeks ago, and we said that that was the greatest of all the songs that Solomon wrote. And so really, it's you could say it's the greatest song that the Old Testament sings. And that is set across in this structure from what we will see tonight is the saddest of all the songs that the Old Testament sings. And this is all kind of held together by that hinge in Ecclesiastes, which we looked at last week. Now, I just want to think with you, and I'd be interested in your feedback on this. When you even just hear the name of this book, this term Lamentations, what does that word mean, or what does it at least reference for us? Okay, so it has the word lament right in it. So it is the idea of lamenting. What then is a lament, or what does it mean to lament? Say again, crying out in sorrow. Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm headed to heat agony on me.
Doom, despair, and agony on me. Okay, deep dark depression. All right, he's not wrong. Okay, so it is an expression. It is a cry of despair, of sorrow, of mourning, you might even say. So, you know, now maybe a good question would be, where in our day and age might we encounter lament, or where might we even practice lament, or seen it practiced, or do we see it practiced at all? Is it an entirely foreign concept to us? Okay, that would be my first answer as well. So possibly, if you're at a funeral, and particularly if it's a funeral of someone you're particularly close to, you probably would participate, maybe not in exactly the same way as we might see it expressed in a book like this, but you would at least join in with those who are expressing their sorrow and their anguish over the death of a loved one. My guess is, you know, you might do this in other ways, although perhaps not so formally. Just anytime something strikes you as, boy, I really wish it wasn't this way. You were thinking what?
Election.
Like an election. Okay, so like the results of an. How many of you have? Well, let's not raise your hands. But yeah, the poll results come in, and it didn't go the way that you want to. And so there's this kind of, you know, all you might say is something like, ugh. But that can be a type of lament, you know, just for anything. Like, okay, go ahead, yes.
I think we had sort of a national lament after 9/11.
Okay.
You know, when the towers came down.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. A somberness, a recognition of the serious and the gravity of all that meant. Yeah, for sure. Which led to people being united for certain causes and against certain causes as it relates to our country. Yeah, for sure. Certainly national tragedies, family tragedies. You know, for some of us, something maybe even as you know, mundane as, yeah, my sports team lost again, or, you know, why is my electric bill so high? Or, you know, something like that. Like, you get this news and it's not what you want. And for some of us, it might seem like a big deal and others not. But there's this, like, again, hug or this expression of, I wish it wasn't this way. And this cry of sorrow, again, in all these ways. So, yes, we could see it. Even though the word lament, we might not think of us of that, what we're doing as lamenting. But you could see, again, how it might come across that way. Now, in Jeremiah's case, and in the case of this book, this was a kind of national tragedy, to your point. This was something, and we'll see this as we go through, but he was lamenting and he was expressing his sorrow and his grief because of what had happened to, not just to him personally, but to the entire nation of Israel and what the Lord had allowed to happen to them. So it's interesting that we come across this, that there's an entire book of the Bible about this concept. And again, it's not a long one, but it is here. We only have 66 of these. And one of them in its entirety is a lament. It is this expression of sorrow, which means that it is right for us as God's people to understand that lament, you could say, is normal or is to be expected, and therefore we ought to have some idea of how to do it well. There is a way to lament in wrong ways and in right ways. And so this book, I think, shows us how to lament well. We have other kinds of laments in the Bible, particularly in the book of Psalms. Now, I don't think, and I tried to look through, skim through my Bible earlier, I don't think that you have any. So remember how we talked through Psalms and we said that some of the that the superscriptions are inspired. So they are written there by the author. I don't think we have any that are specifically called by the author a lament. I don't think. Others of you may correct me later if I need to be corrected. But you have some that are very obviously expressions of lament and of sorrow, and I just used Psalm 88 as an example. There are probably a dozen or more that would actually fall into this category. But let me just read, and you can turn there if you want, but I'm going to read just a sampling of these verses from Psalm 88, and I'll start in verse 3. The psalmist says, "My soul is full of troubles. My life draws near to Sheol. I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am a man who has no strength, like one set loose among the dead, like the slain that lie in the grave, like those whom you remember no more, for they are cut off from your hand." He's saying this to God. And he goes on, "You have put me in the depths of the pit, in the regions dark and deep. Your wrath lies heavy upon me, and you overwhelm me with all your waves." This is the cry of the psalmist to the Lord, acknowledging the reality of the difficulties he's facing. And so you have here a category in some of these psalms of, I would say, a right way to bring to the Lord, in a sense, to his attention, the sorrows of life that, by the way, are from his hand. And the psalmist acknowledges that. You have made my life lamentable. And therefore, I'm expressing to you that lament with my words. So we have it in certain psalms. We also have it in this whole book. And we have, in this thinking about this week, reminded me of an article that I came across some years ago. Some of you may be familiar with this, but I think you'll find it interesting even if you're not. But before I direct you to the article, let me ask this. Do we have laments as part of our liturgy, let's say? In other words, in our church services or in our, even maybe in your personal, you know, worship, do you leave room for lament? Or do we, or have we, or how might we? Would be a way to ask it. Any thoughts on that, or have you seen this practiced, or do you think it good, bad, or otherwise? Some of you are nodding your head. I don't know if you want to offer any examples or not. Go ahead.
Well, with regard to Christ, we have that O Sacred Head, now wounded.
Okay. Yep.
That really kind of emphasizes passion.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great example. Very good. So certain maybe of the hymns we would sing, certain of the scriptures we would read, even certain of the prayers we might pray, okay, depending on circumstances.
Yeah, with the situation with Brother Carl, there was a cry of pain.
Yeah.
And deliverance because of our care for him. Yes.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think we all sensed that, for sure. I ask it that way, somewhat just... you know, maybe for your own reflection, because of this article, and I'll go ahead and read you the title of it, or I'll put it here on the board. But I came across this article: "What Can Miserable Christians Sing?" That's the name of this article. This is written in 2005 by Carl Truman. Some of you will know that name. He's a British scholar who currently teaches at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. But he wrote this article. Now, as I understand it, just based on what he wrote here, his reason even for putting this into writing is because as he attended various church services, he would come into those church services having been through some very difficult things personally and spiritually, and yet the posture of the church services was all very cheerful and joyful. And to him, it just felt like these people don't have any idea the weightiness that I'm bringing into a service like this. And so he put some thoughts to writing. And I just wonder if sometimes, and it'd be interesting maybe to hear some of your thoughts even for our own church, but probably this is not hard to picture, where you have churches who think, hey, we need to be cheerful, we need to be smiley, we need to be happy. And obviously there's nothing wrong with singing happy songs, right? We would all want to sing joyful things, but is there a place also to sing hymns of lament? I want to read some of this to you, and I promise we're going to get to the text. I'll try to read through this fast, but I thought this was interesting, and I would commend this article to you. So this is some of what Carl Truman writes. He says, let us look at the contemporary language of worship. Worship is a difficult subject, and having experienced and generally appreciated worship across the whole evangelical spectrum, I am myself concerned here less with the form of worship than I am with its content. I would, however, like to make just one observation. The Psalms, the Bible's own hymn book, have almost entirely dropped from view in the contemporary Western evangelical scene. I'm not certain about why this should be, but I have an instinctive feel that it has more than a little to do with the fact that a high proportion of songs are taken up with lamentation, with feeling sad, unhappy, tormented, and broken. In modern Western culture, these are simply not emotions which have much credibility. Sure, people still feel those things, but to admit that they are a normal part of one's everyday life is tantamount to admitting that one has failed in today's health, wealth, and happiness society. I'll read just a little bit more. He says, now one would not expect the world to have much time for the weakness of the psalmist's cries. It is disturbing, however, when these cries of lamentation disappear from the language of the church. Perhaps the Western church feels no need to lament, but then it is sadly deluded about how healthy it really is. Perhaps, and this is more likely, we have drunk so deeply at the well of modern Western materialism that we simply do not know what to do with such cries and regard them as little short of embarrassing. Yet the human condition is a poor one, and Christians who are aware of the deceitfulness of the human heart and are looking for a better country should know this. A diet of unremittingly jolly hymns inevitably creates an unrealistic horizon of expectation which sees the normative Christian life as one long triumphalist street party, a theologically incorrect and pastorally disastrous scenario in a world of broken individuals. He goes on to talk about whether or not this kind of approach would even be recognized by Christians in certain areas of China, Africa, Eastern Europe, not to mention certain of those in the Bible who expressed great lamentations, Abraham, Joseph, David, Jeremiah, and a number of the psalmists. So I would commend this article to you. It's got a memorable enough title. Perhaps you'll remember to Google it on your own. But what can miserable Christians sing? And so he obviously says that this is an important kind of thing to wonder. So, and I would just, I think by way of application, I would maybe say it's normal for any of us to come into a service bearing any kind of and any number of burdens that others may not have any idea about. And we would not want to gloss over that and just, nor would we expect you to just gloss over it and act as if everything's okay. You know, in other words, let's not be those who, well, because I'm here and because I'm around these people, I've got to look like I have it all together. So we can be real with each other and we can sing joyful things, even in the pain. But sometimes it's good also for us to, I listened actually to it. What drew me to this article was an interview that he did about it, and he talked about what he called minor key hymns, those that don't, you know, maybe sound as fun to sing, but we need them because they remind us and they slow us down and they put words to our grief. So, just I think worth some thought. Okay, let's see now if we can look more at the text here. There is a kind of historical setting to the book, and it actually comes in a couple of different places, and one of them is the very last chapter of Jeremiah. So if you're in Lamentations 1, you may want to turn the page backwards 1 to Jeremiah 52. And essentially, Jeremiah 52, so the last chapter of that book, and 2 Kings 25, the last chapter of that book, really contain the same account. And the wording is actually very similar. And this has actually led some to conclude that Jeremiah, who wrote the book that bears his name, also possibly authored 1 and 2 Kings, because they end in the same place. So perhaps that is the case. And what you have in Jeremiah 52 is the account of the fall of Jerusalem as it was taken into captivity and overrun by Babylon. So I won't read through through all of this, but perhaps some of these verses would help us to just sort of get a handle on exactly what has happened historically that would lead into this book of Lamentations. Chapter 52 and verse 1, Zedekiah, the king of Jerusalem, was 21 years old when he became king. He reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. Verse 2, he also did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that Jehoiakim had done. For because of the anger of the Lord, this happened in Jerusalem and Judah, till he finally cast them out from his presence. Then Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. And it came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, in the tenth month, on the tenth day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came against Jerusalem and encamped against it, and they built a siege wall against it all around. And if you were to skip down to about verse 9 or so, picking it up there. So the Babylonians took the king, brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah in the land of Hamath, and he pronounced judgment on him. Then the king of Babylon killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. He killed the princes of Judah in Riblah. He also put out the eyes of Zedekiah, and the king of Babylon bound him in bronze fetters, took him to Babylon, and put him in prison till the day of his death. And then just a couple more verses here, verse 12. Now in the fifth month, on the tenth day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard who served the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. He burned the house of the Lord and the king's house, all the houses of Jerusalem, that is, all the houses of the great, he burned with fire. And all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down all the walls of Jerusalem all around. We'll stop there. I think you have enough there to sort of get the idea of this. This was, and keeping in mind that this was after really centuries of the Lord through his prophets urging the people of Jerusalem to turn back to him. To remember the law of Moses, to follow the commands of the Lord that were given to them and were to be passed down to them because they had wandered. And they had wandered, in a sense, the nation wandered because the kings had wandered. And so you read about the downfall of these kings, such as Zedekiah and Jehoiakim before him. And so the judgment that the Lord brought, not just upon those kings and upon even their families, but upon the nation as a whole. So that's the setting for Lamentations. It's in response to that we have this book. Jeremiah, based on all that he sees, as he even was alive during this time and would have experienced it and would have been one of the captives, writes and pens this lament, this sorrow, this cry of grief to the Lord as a result of what he has seen. So, give just a little bit of an overview of the book here, but before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about the structure of the book because I think it's quite interesting. This book is written as a song. It is a book of poetry. There really is no narrative at all in the book, so it doesn't continue the story as much as it does just lament over the story. So the historical facts of it are given in Jeremiah 52. The poetic cry coming out of that is what you have in Lamentations. Now, structurally, Lamentations is interesting in the sense that the whole book is this acrostic poem. Now, how many of you know what I mean by an acrostic poem? Okay, anybody want to define it for us? Go ahead. Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, so you could do that either like with a singular word itself, okay, so,
or a phrase,
or or you could do it alphabetically, right? A is for this, B is for that. And that is, that second way, that alphabetic way, is the way that Jeremiah operates here. Now, of course, he's using the Hebrew language, not the English language, as we would expect him to. But there are, in Hebrew, 22 consonants. Okay, 22 letters, essentially, in the Hebrew alphabet. And so each verse, if you look at the chapters here, and you can look at the total verses in each one. How many verses are there in chapter 1? 22. How many in chapter 2? 22. And so on in chapter 4 and 5 are the same way. Chapter 3 is the different one. But in each of these that have 22 verses, it's like each verse is the beginning of a line of poetry. And each verse begins with a consecutive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So again, if he were writing in English, it would be something like line A, line number 1 begins with letter A, line number 2 with B, 3 with C, 4 with D, all the way on down till he gets to Z. It's that way, except he's obviously using the Hebrew alphabet. So he does that all the way through in chapter 1, all the way through in chapter 2, and then in chapter 3, he does it, except he triples it. So there are 66 verses in chapter 3, 22 times 3, and there are three consecutive lines with each of those letters. So again, three A's, three B's, three C's, three D's, again, you know, just equated to Hebrew, all the way down through the whole alphabet. And then in chapters 4 and 5, it goes back to using each one only once. So it's almost like this. It's done obviously artistically, but in a sense you could also say mathematically. He's counted out the number of lines to the song to equal the number of letters in the alphabet. And I think one commentator I was reading this week says what this does is it allows him to show the fullness of the grief that he's expressing while also putting constraints on it, which I thought was a good way to think of it. So does that make sense, more or less, what I'm saying? So each line, in a sense, kind of stands on its own, but that's the structure of it. So it doesn't, again, you wouldn't necessarily understand that just reading it in English, but I think it's noteworthy nonetheless. Okay, any questions or anything to add from anybody before we kind of go through some of the material here? Okay, again, hopefully this is helpful. Hopefully it's not too technical. All right, so what we'll do is again, this is a short book, so I've just kind of put the summary of each chapter. And each chapter, again, because it is written in its own kind of self-contained way, so each one is kind of like its own poem. It's almost like there are five different poems in this book, so that they're each all the its own contained section. And chapter 1 begins just with this analysis of the city of Zion, the city of Jerusalem, and its ruin. And so, again, I'll read just a sampling of these verses. Perhaps it would be helpful for you to follow along in some of these. So verse 1 from the very beginning. Again, Jeremiah speaking of the city of Jerusalem itself. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow is she who is great among the nations. The princess among the provinces has become a slave. So you see there, even from the opening verse, the contrast between what she was, what the city was, to what she is now, what she has become as a result of the overthrow that she has experienced. You see this again down in verses 2 and 3. She weeps bitterly in the night. Her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They've become her enemies. Judah has gone into captivity, under affliction and hard servitude. She dwells among the nations. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtake her in dire straits. Skip down to verse 5. Her adversaries have become the master. Her enemies prosper, for the Lord has afflicted her. Again, who does he point to as the actor in all of this? It's the Lord, right? He's the one who's done this. So it's not Lord, why have you allowed this to happen? It's, Lord, you have done this to us. We're acknowledging that this is by your hand. So again, picking it up there. For the Lord has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. And you have the mention of the enemy there again in verse 10. The enemy or the adversary has spread his hand over all her pleasant things, for she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary. So the picture is that at one time this was to be the place where only those who were of the Jews, only those who were pure could come into the sanctuary. Well, now those who are unclean among the Gentiles have come into the holy place and have desecrated it and have taken its people captive. Skip down to verse 17 again, just sort of summarizing some of this. Zion spreads out her hands, but no one comforts her. The Lord has commanded concerning Jacob that those around him become his adversaries. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them. The Lord is righteous. So there's even this acknowledgement that yes, this has happened, and yet the Lord is in the right in doing it. He doesn't blame God for what has happened. The Lord is righteous, for I rebelled against his commandment. Hear now, all peoples, and behold my sorrow. My virgins and my young men have gone into captivity. And then just like at the beginning of the poem, verse 21 again reiterates some of these things. They have heard that I sigh, but no one comforts me. All my enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that you've done it. Bring on the day that you've announced that they may become like me. So it's almost like he's even in the judgment that's come upon Jerusalem, he's awaiting a judgment that will one day come upon those who oppose the Lord. So that's chapter 1, how the ruin of Zion is described. And then in chapter 2, this picture of that particular actions of the Lord against Jerusalem, against Israel. What has he done? So yes, Zion's been ruined, but how is the Lord the one who has brought this about? Again, just I'll highlight some of these specific phrases that I think are interesting. Look at verse 6. So Lamentations 2:6. He has done violence to his tabernacle as if it were a garden. He has destroyed the place of his assembly. The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. In his burning indignation, he has spurned the king and the priest. And some have suggested, I think probably rightfully, that the comparison of the tabernacle to the garden is intentional there, reminding us that at one time there also was this state of perfection in Eden, but then because of the actions of those dwelling in it, judgment came upon the garden. And so now it's coming upon the tabernacle and the dwelling place of God, not in a garden, but in the city of God, and judgment is coming upon it in the same way. Again, I'll just summarize some of these. Verse 8, the Lord has purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He has stretched out a line. He has not withdrawn his hand from destroying. Therefore, he's caused the rampart and wall to lament. They languish together. Her gates have sunk into the ground. He's destroyed and broken her bars. Her king and her princes are among the nations. The law is no more. So why is, and these are tied together, I think, why is the city no more? What had they ignored? The Lord's law. The law of Moses. So he's making that connection. The city, the Lord has worked his judgment against us as a city because we have ignored his law. And her prophets find no vision from the Lord. They've ignored not just the law, but the prophets. And therefore, this judgment has come upon them. And all of this, again, is according to the will of God. Look at verse 17. The Lord has done what he's purposed. He's fulfilled his word, which he commanded in the days of old. He's thrown down and not pitied. He's caused an enemy to rejoice over you. He has exalted the horn of your adversaries. He's exalted, you could say, the strength of your enemies, the strength of your foes. Now, I'm going to skip chapter 3 just because I want to end with that chapter, it being in the middle and I think kind of being the hinge of the whole thing. So focus just a little bit on chapter 4, the way that the Lord vindicates His own holiness. So we talk a good bit about the way the Lord is obviously faithful to His people because of the promises that He's given to them. But in, I think, an even greater sense, the Lord is not just faithful to His people, He's faithful to Himself. What I mean by that is the Lord has to be true to who He is. If He is a God of holiness, then He enforces that holiness in such a way that when His people do not comply with it, He is still acting in His holiness by the judgment that He brings upon them. And that does not contradict what we understand to be His faithful and steadfast love to His people. They go hand in hand. So the Lord's judgment upon Israel is not an example of His unfaithfulness to His people as much as it is an example of His faithfulness to Himself. So that's what I think chapter 4 primarily emphasizes. Again, maybe just a few verses here to sort of illustrate that. Look at verse 11, for example. 4:11, the Lord has fulfilled His fury, He has poured out His fierce anger, He has kindled a fire in Zion, and has devoured its foundations. The kings of the earth and all the inhabitants of the world would not have believed that the adversary and the enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem because of the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests, who shed in her midst the blood of the just. Why do you think the Lord would specifically mention the prophets and the priests? And actually, earlier in the book we read as well, He mentions the kings. Why specifically those offices? Any thoughts?
They were the ones supposed to be providing spiritual leadership.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We mentioned this earlier, but the nation had gone astray as sort of the, you would say, I think, the natural fallout of the direction its leaders had gone. The prophets and priests, the very ones who, not to say they were all unfaithful, certainly Israel had faithful prophets, certainly Jeremiah was one of them. And it's interesting, though, that even though Jeremiah was one of them, a lot of times he still uses this first person, like he groups himself in with the wicked, right? Because of my sins, the Lord has done this. So he doesn't exempt himself and you know, like stand across from the people and say, you're getting what you deserve. He's like, no, this is on us. This is on all of us. But it was because of those who were in leadership, it seems, that the Lord is again, having to be true to His own name. Look at verse 16, maybe as one more example of this. So 4:16, the face of the Lord scattered them. He no longer regards them. The people do not respect the priest nor show favor to the elders. And then the book seems to conclude with this cry in chapter 5 of the Lord's mercy and this call for Him to remember them even in their captivity. So 5:1, remember, O Lord, what has come upon us. Look and behold our reproach. Verse 7, our fathers sinned and are no more, but we bear their iniquities. We are the ones who are suffering because of the way that those before us have sinned. Look down at, I think the conclusion of the book is rather remarkable. Look at verse 19. You, O Lord, remain forever, your throne from generation to generation. Why do you forget us forever and forsake us for so long a time? Turn us back to you, O Lord, and we will be restored. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are very angry with us. Now, I want to just remind us of the way that all this plays out, because thankfully this is not how things end. For like, what would eventually happen? Out of captivity, the Lord would do what? Rebuild, restore, gather them in together. So we'll see some of this even in some of the books we've yet to get to. But this is the cry of the people. Lord, you are as of now, seemingly forsaking us, and yet do not forsake us forever. Be true to your word and your promises to us. And they seem to have hope in this. Like, this is not a prayer of, like, we don't think this will happen. This is, Lord, based on who you are and what you've promised to us in the past, yes, you're fulfilling your word to us for judgment now, but we trust that you will also fulfill your word to us of the salvation, that you will bring us out of this into that salvation. So that's how the book ends, with this prayer for hope. But go back just to some of these things in the middle, because in the middle there is also this expression of hope in the midst of judgment. And it's interesting, I think, that it comes right in the middle of this book. And it comes with some of, I think, probably the more familiar verses in this book. So we'll pick it up and highlight just a few of these, starting in verse 22. Through the Lord's mercies, we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. It is good that one should hope and wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Verse 31, for the Lord will not cast off forever. Though he causes grief, yet he will show compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. For he does not afflict, and the ESV rendering here is, he does not afflict, the New King James rendering is, he does not afflict willingly. The more literal translation would be something like, what?
From the heart.
From his heart. That's very interesting. The affliction of the Lord is more, I think we would say, out of necessity to uphold the holiness of his name than it is to, because he desires out of his heart to want to do this. So I'm certain all of us as parents have said to our children something like, there are consequences for your actions, and therefore this hurts me more than it hurts you. I used to think that was such a lie. Baloney. But this is where we get the idea from. We understand as parents that I don't, and we mean it, like, truthfully, when we say, like, I don't want to do this. This is not what I want to do. But I do want you to understand that there's a right and there's a wrong. And you chose what was wrong, and there are consequences for what was wrong, and so I'm going to help you experience those consequences in such a way that next time you will choose right. And so the Lord's affliction upon his people, the judgment upon his people, is not from his heart. His heart is to be gracious and merciful and full of compassion to his people. And that's what you have here right in the middle of this book. Which is remarkable, that of all the laments, all the sadness, all the sorrow, all the reality of the weightiness and gravity of the devastation that Jeremiah and all of his people had experienced, they didn't lose their hope. Because their hope was not in an earthly king or an earthly priest or an earthly prophet or in the temple itself or the sanctuary or their city or their walls. Their hope ultimately wasn't in those things. It was in the Lord himself, who was faithful to his word all along, at every step, even when they had not been. So, I normally at this time I would say I want us to conclude there, but I actually want to conclude slightly differently. We've got one more song that I would like for us to sing together. Terry, you want to come up and lead us in this? I think it would feel wrong. I would feel wrong, at least, if we didn't stand and sing this together.
We'll stand and sing it together?
We'll stand and sing it together.
Some of us went out of here this morning singing the last hymn.